Next Sunday evening, it'll be our Heart and Home Conference. Scott Owen will be our speaker. He's been involved in a lot of church assistance type ministries where he's done, been kind of a counseling pastor and now doing some of those similar things with the mission agency there. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing from him. He's not somebody that I know really well, but is one of the individuals that over time, when we see him at conference and such, he'll come up and talk to me. And at one point, when I didn't know him hardly at all, he calls up out of the blue and just starts talking to me and how are things in Cumberland, Iowa, and how can I pray for you? And when we get on the phone, it's never just jumping straight to business. There's always a lot of relational aspects to, has a concern for people and their lives and where they are. And so I really appreciate that about him and will really enjoy getting to know them in this coming week. So last time we were talking about pottery, and we didn't get all the way through. We talked a lot of the technical stuff, and we didn't get to the scriptures, but we're talking about the tradesmen had special places within the city where they got together, they lived together, they worked together, they worshiped together. They just had these little micro communities, very tight, and it also gave them a little bit of political power. And one of those was the potters, and we saw how there was a lot of careful work with the hands, but again, a lot of work. They had to dig up their clay, and then what did they have to do with their clay? Stomp on it. We said we should call this the work of their feet instead of the work of their hands, right? It's the stomping grapes, stomping, you know, the olive oil and stomping clay. So they have all these different work of their feet. A lot of skill. These things take time to learn the tricks of the trade, and each of these trades, they are mastering a specific medium. That this is clay. The next we're going to talk about is carpenters, and so they're working with wood. And so God has created within his creation wonderful elements that have these unique qualities. I mean, who would have thought that you could dig up mud, fashion it into wonderful shapes and things, and then bake it so hard that it becomes like a rock? I mean, it's just a wonder of God's creation. And so we're talking about how they did that with the development of the wheel and how they can turn that wheel and shape that pot up. But I want to get to the scriptures this evening. We've noted on several of these how God uses the unique aspects of each trade or each occupation to illustrate and to teach us and connect us with spiritual truths. And it's the same with the work of the potter. 1 Chronicles 4 and verse 23. Okay, we talked about how they had these little guilds, but then there were those that were skilled in their labors so that they became the king's potter. The king, you can go back and look at like when Solomon talks about all of the different animals and things that are coming into his palace, and you get an impression that there are a lot of people that are being fed at the king's table or from the king's resources. Well, that's because you have all of these tradesmen which are necessary for the functioning of the palace. And so, you know, just like anybody else going through their day, they're wearing out their clothes, they're breaking their pots, and they have to make new pots. Well, you want the very best for the king's palace, and so he has his own potters. Proverbs 22 and verse 29. Okay, so there was a reality. If you do well, you're going to be recognized, and even the king. If you master your craft, you'll be serving kings and not peasants. And there's kind of a motivation there. Jeremiah 18, verses 1 through 6.
The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, "For as the clay is in the potter's kiln, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel."
Okay. He gives us this wonderful illustration. He sends Jeremiah down to the potter's house so that he sees this right in front of him. And so he goes down to the potter's house, and he's standing around watching the potter work. You know, it's like when people stand around and watch you work, right? And so he's working this pot, and something happens. There's a flaw in the clay, or he just didn't get it worked just right, and it started to flop over, and it just wasn't what it was supposed to be. What does he do? He just takes that clay, smashes it down, pounds it together, works it back into a lump, and he starts all over from the very beginning. And he starts working that clay up, and he might decide, you know, this clay is not the kind of clay that I need for the pot I wanted to make, but this is the clay I have, and so I'll make this other pot, which it's appropriate for. It might not be appropriate to make a fancy vase to put, you know, on display, but it'll make a good bowl to work in the kitchen. And so he changes his purpose for that clay, and he molds the clay however he wants to mold the clay. And that is such a lesson to us, and it's something that we're going to struggle with, because we like to hold in our pride that we have some specific value, we have some specific motivations, we want to accomplish certain things in life, and things just don't always work out the way we think it should be going. We're trying and putting all of our efforts in something, and God is saying, no, that's not the pot that I want you to be. Or there's times when we mess up, and you know, we're flawed. And we sometimes get discouraged and think, well, now God can't use me at all. And you realize that that's not the case. There may be a flaw, and it may take you out of one aspect of ministry or something, but God is able to flatten that clay down, work it up, and mold it into something else. It's not that he's going to just take that clay and throw it away. He's able to mold that clay into a vessel appropriate to the clay that he's working with. I think there's just a lot of things there that we could meditate on and just realize the lessons that God is able to mold and shape our lives, and he can do with us whatever he pleases. And that's a hard lesson. We want God to do specific things with us. A lot of times we want God just to leave us alone because we've got it figured out. We've got a place of comfort. We got our life kind of situated the way we like it. But God is able to mold us and shape us however he wants to do that. And sometimes hard things come into life, and it doesn't take us directions we wanted to go. Now, who knew that we would end up in this place through the storyline that we have? You know, how we meet the people we're going to marry, where we end up finding work, just all kinds of little things in which God directs and leads and moves, and it can be in ways that we never expected and puts us in places we never thought we'd end up going. God is able and has the right to shape and form us in whatever way he wants to do so. And that's a hard thing for us at times to submit to. Romans 9, verses 20 and 21. Again, we're coming back to God's right, his sovereign right, his authority over our lives to do with as he pleases. And, you know, there's things that we don't understand and things that are hard to comprehend. And even as you look at Romans chapter 9, you're getting into, predestination and things like this. And it might be kind of hard to understand. And we'd argue back at God. But the reality is, God is eternal. He is the creator of all things, and that places all things under his authority, that he can do with it however he wants to do with it. And if he set the rules, who are you and I to argue about what his rules are? If he sets a direction, who are you and I to argue with him about the direction that he leads? There's going to be times when God works in such a life that he makes a vessel of honor. And, you know, we think of a vessel of honor in our homes as something you would set out on display and use it appropriately. You care for it. It's precious. It's, it holds a certain value. It holds a prominent place in the house. But then there's also vessels of dishonor. And this illustration goes back a couple generations. Usually in the bedrooms, they had a vessel of dishonor that they used in the middle of the night and then dumped in the morning. All right? It still had a function. It was still very important and useful. But it was not what you had set out on the living room table. You know, you don't go get the urinal pot from the hospital and set it there on the table, right? But that's kind of the idea. They're both important. And it's easy sometimes, you know, we're looking at some of the great men in church history in our Sunday school. And we're going to come across those that God uses in very prominent, very visible, very blessed ways. And to recognize that God has made vessels of honor, that he's just bestowed a wonderful blessing of his grace to bring many to Christ. But that doesn't diminish who we are, that we may be vessels of honor, we may be vessels of usefulness. And if we will purify ourselves, we will be vessels of honor. And so we have a little bit of say in that, but he's going to be able to make us, mold us, and shape us whether we have a stiff neck or not. And he will reshape that pot accordingly. See, Jeremiah chapter 19. Okay, go and buy this pot. He's going to make another demonstration and goes out to the pot shard gate where there's all kinds of broken pieces there. Drop down to verses 10 and 11. Okay, this is interesting. He doesn't just tell them to take a pot and break it. Tell them to take a pot, go to the pot shard gate where all of the pots are broken. This is where they come out, you know, the pots that broke in the kiln, the pots that didn't come out, they got misshapen when they got heated, and there's no good use for them. The potter comes out, and he smashes it up against the city wall, and all of the debris falls there. And so he takes them to the place of the broken pots to break his pot. I just think that, you know, you could have done that anywhere, right? But it just emphasizes the lesson. You're surrounding, you know, everything in your visual perspective has to do with pots that are broken. And so he breaks the pot as a lesson to Israel. Psalm 2 in verses 8 and 9. Here we have a picture of Jesus Christ, the coming King. All of the nations are going to be given to him, and he has authority to do with them as he wills, and he will break them. He'll break their authority, he'll break their rebellion, he'll break their sinfulness. He'll break them down and bring them under subjection to his rule and his domain. It's quoted again in Revelation 2:27, we don't have to read it, but we see how it is applied to Christ there. Isaiah 30 and verse 14. Okay, so the pots are very fragile things, very useful, but very fragile, and so if you set it down too hard, you could crack your pot, and then it loses its usefulness. And oftentimes, they don't just put a crack in them, they break into pieces, especially if you drop it. It just shatters into a million pieces. And so there's this idea, again, of God's authority. He doesn't just, you know, tap the pot and crack it. He's going to just smash it to bits so that there isn't one piece large enough to be useful. Now, in that day and age, especially in the cities where they had the areas where the potters worked, the poor would send their children to the potter's gate and find a piece of broken pot. Every evening, they'd take this shard of pot and they would go to the baker's. And the bakers in the evening are cleaning out their ovens. And there's coals. And so the kids would get some coals on that pot, and they would carry it home and start their evening fire to cook their meal and keep their house warm in the evening. And so this was something that was very common. You'd have this parade of young kids carrying their little pot of fire with them. And then, of course, the pot shard would probably just get discarded. They'd go find another one the next day. They're common. But, you know, you don't have to have a very large piece of pot to carry a few little coals to get a fire started. And so you get this picture. It's completely, utterly destroyed. The other thing, you take your water pot to the well and you set it down too hard and it breaks. Well, you can't carry water in that anymore. And archaeologists like to dig wells because a lot of stuff falls into the well. You bend over and something falls off your clothing. You break a pot or the handle breaks off and the pot falls into the water. And you're not going to retrieve it. It just sinks to the bottom and then it gets buried. And they like to dig that stuff up. But poor people that can't afford a pot, you're coming to the well, you're thirsty. Well, there might be a chunk of broken pot laying there that somebody had set their pot down too hard and it broke and it can't be carried home, but it's got enough of a curve you can get enough to drink out of. So you use it to get your drink. It doesn't take a very large piece of pot. And again, pointing to the fact that those pieces are going to be broken down so far that there is absolutely no use for them. I can't pronounce this Greek word, but it's translated sincere in our Bibles oftentimes. And the word means tested by light. And this may have a connection to the realm of the pottery. As a scoundrel of a potter might have worked up a wonderful pot and he went and tried to bake it, and in the baking process it didn't bake evenly and it cracked. It didn't break all to pieces, but there's a crack in it, and so he really shouldn't sell it. But he's a scoundrel. And so he'll take some clay and he'll fill that crack up, or he'll take some wax. A lot of times they talk about it being wax. And they'd fill that crack with wax and they'd sit it out there, and somebody would buy that pot. And you know what's going to happen to it the first time it gets used? What's going to happen to a cracked pot? It's going to break. So he just cheated somebody. And so when you went to buy your pots, you wanted to make sure you were buying a good pot. You'd take your pot and you'd hold it up to the sun, because the wax would allow sunlight through the crack. And you'd see that crack in there. You couldn't see it just looking at the outside, but putting it up to the sunlight, you'd be able to see that crack. And so it was a sense of sincerity, something that is tested. Philippians 1 and verse 10. Okay, Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 6. Okay, we have a picture of death. And here, again, taking your pot to go to the fountain to get your daily allotment of water. The water picture of life. If your pot holds the water, it's a picture that you have life. But if your pot is broken, what happens to the water? If you got a bad crack in your pot, the water pours out of it, right? And so your pot does not hold life. So there, Solomon is using this poetically to describe death. You no longer are able to contain life in your physical body. You've grown so old that the life has seeped out. It's all gone. You've died. I want to talk about carpenters for a little bit here. The Jewish people were not actually known for their carpentry. They were a nomadic group historically. They were slaves. They lived in the wilderness and so forth. And so they didn't come into the promised land with a lot of carpentry skills. There were some. We see that as God blessed them to be able to fashion the articles of the tabernacle and the all of those things. But there was a certain special God-given gifts there, but they just weren't generally known as carpenters. And 1 Chronicles 14:1, when it comes to big carpentry projects, they were importing their workers. Okay, so David was getting a house built for him, and they sent workers from another country to do it. And we see that again when they went to build the temple. We think of carpenters, they really worked on two different levels, and maybe more than that, but generally there were the carpenters which were builders. They would build houses, build structures and buildings and big projects like that, where they would have to go out and get the tree, shape it down into beams and things like that, and big, heavy projects. Took a lot of effort, a lot of labor. Of course, they didn't have houses with sloped roofs so much like we have, or the Romans brought in the domed roof. They had flat-topped roofs. And so to build those, they would generally have kind of mason or brick or something for the walls, but then the carpenter would come in and he would set beams on top of that wall, and then over top of that he'd lay all kinds of brushwood to make a mat that would hold up his building materials, and then he would smother over top of that mud or clay or something like that to give it a surface that a person could walk on and keep clean. And on really fancy houses, they would then set tiles on top of that to make it really nice. And so that was the kind of work that he would do. He would have to build doorposts, which would be big, heavy lumbers, doors. Then you get down to more intricate work. There would be carpenters that would be able to make lock devices and keys, keys that are made out of wood. You know, there's a problem with that. Wood has grain, and it likes to break when you make it too small. And, you know, you could make very small, intricate things, but you don't want to put a lot of weight or pressure on them. But when you're trying to turn a lock, it takes a lot of pressure to do that. And so how big is your key going to be? It's not the kind of keys you're going to put in your pocket, right? They were very large keys. And so they still were able to make interesting things like a lock that was unique to a specific key. So there's some real craftsmanship that is involved there. But most of the carpentry would probably be small items. A carpenter would make items for a household. It would be bowls and utensils. It would be lattice work for a window or maybe around the top of their house. It would be very common stuff that you wouldn't have to be overly precise and fancy, just the common everyday kind of things you'd use and wear out. And that's what would keep the carpenter busy, because you use it and you wear it out. Plows, farm utensils and things would need repaired or would wear out and have to be remade. They'd make carts, cartwheels. For inside the house, they might make a low table or a chest that you would store something in. So a lot of it was these little projects. And so many of the carpenters and other artisans would not work in a shop. You know, what would be the problem of working in a shop in Israel? Hot. We have no fans. The building gets hot as you're working. And you want to be someplace where you're going to catch a breeze. So instead of building yourself a workshop, you'd probably have a very small workshop or even just work out of your house, and you'd go and sit at the door of your house on the ground to do your work. The ground makes a wonderful table. You don't have to build a bench. It holds your tools right there close to where you're at. You'll be hunting for them every time you lay them down, right? That's the way it is. But it's there. You know it's within reach. You just got to find it. What else is a problem? Not just the heat. Okay. That's good. You get a good breeze, takes all that debris away from you. You don't have to clean up the place, right? We are so accustomed to electricity. We come in here and we've got light. But a house or a shop like that without electricity would be like working in a cave. And so instead of working in their cave, they would come out to just outside their door where they got plenty of God's created sunlight and be able to see their work and the intricate things they're trying to do, they need to be able to see. And so they'd work right out there on the ground oftentimes. Of course, some of that specialized into being able to make musical instruments and things like that. So there was some real skill and specialty and mastery of their work. I kind of like this picture. This is a Roman period, and you can see a little bit of a carpenter shop there. You've got a man working on a sawhorse with a plane. You've got guys that are cutting out lumber with a two-man saw. And then you got these two guys that are gotten into a squabble. And that's what happens when you try to use a two-man saw. That they're going to settle their fight right there, I think. The tools of the trade haven't changed a whole lot until electricity. And so they had saws. A very early saw would have been like a flint knife that was chipped in a way that the teeth would be rough and offset, and they'd be able to run that across wood and cut it. But they did have metal that they would have, like a piece of ribbon of metal with teeth cut into it, and put on a wooden structure to make a saw blade out of it. And they had ways of making drills. Very early on, it'd just be a piece of sharp pointed flint on a stick that you could rotate back and forth. And that really is pretty basic. They'd even, you know how you Boy Scouts would make a fire with the bow with the string, and you'd cup over it and you turn it quickly? Well, they could do that with a drill too. So they had a lot of the basic things. A lot of it was axe-like tools that would shape wood. But early on, those axe heads were attached to wooden handles, often with like leather lashings. And as you worked with a tool, that leather or the fibers that they would have used to attach the head to the handle would get to stretching, and the head would become loose. And so it was a hazard, a known hazard, a common hazard, that head would come off and it could hurt somebody. Mark 6 and verse 3, we see that Jesus was a carpenter, and that brings a lot of the interest to the topic of carpenter. But it's interesting to me that we've seen so many lessons with the shepherd and the vine and the potter, but when it comes to the carpenter, it isn't used quite as readily. It's not used quite as clearly. And you would think that with Jesus being a carpenter, there would be all kinds of connections there. Isaiah 44 and verse 13. Okay, he mentions a number of tools there that the carpenter would use. He uses a measuring line. We have a tape measure. Not too much difference there. He had a piece of chalk to mark it with. I use a carpenter's pencil. He uses a plane. I have a joiner and a planer in my shop. They're run by electricity, but it's the same concept. I have not mastered the hand plane. That takes a lot of skill to master. He uses a compass, and that's a tool to make a circle, and we still use all those tools that are mentioned there. Unfortunately, we see how the use of their skills were being misused in making idols rather than giving glory to God. Isaiah 10 and verse 15. Okay, similar to the potter, that we need to get in our place. We need to recognize God's authority in our life. Just as an axe does not work on its own, it doesn't have anything to be proud of in itself. Its skill is directly resourced in the hand that is wielding it. And that's our lives. We are the creation. We are the tool. God is the craftsman. He has a right to pick his tool and to use whatever tool he wants in whatever way he wants. Let's see, what was that verse? Okay, Judges 5 and verse 26. Okay, mention of a hammer there. That's probably not the carpenter's hammer, but it is a pretty basic carpenter tool. This is probably a larger hammer, and oftentimes it could just be a large piece of stone that is just the right shape attached to a piece of wood, but it takes a lot of heft to be swinging a stone axe to bury tent stakes. And those are not, you know, your little metal tent stakes that you have that come with your pop-up tent. You know, these are big, long, heavy-duty stakes that have to be driven feet into the ground because you're driving it oftentimes into sand. And so, kind of a different culture there. Deuteronomy 19:5. I'm sorry, I'm harder of hearing. I'm going to have to look that one up here.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. This was such a common situation that it was used as an illustration, you know, for the manslaughter. The man that accidentally kills somebody could flee to the city of refuge and be safe. And the choice of illustration is working with your neighbor, cutting down a tree and having the axe handle fly off and kill your friend. So this was a real danger as you worked with that. If you didn't take care of your tools, or if you've been working too aggressively and haven't noticed it, it comes flying off there. It's really dangerous. And so, you know, carpentry still is dangerous. 2 Kings 6 and verse 5. All right. So these things really do happen. Right? The axe head comes off, flies into the river. And Jeremiah 10:4. Okay, in this case, we're talking about an idol that a carpenter has to attach so it doesn't fall over. And they use a hammer and nails. Exodus 31 and verse 5. Okay, Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 11. Okay, and these other verses have kind of to do with that. When we're talking about fastening something securely, we're talking about using a nail or a peg and driving it firmly. Now, Colossians 2:14. Okay, it's firmly attached to the cross. Just a wonderful picture connected there with our carpenter. Though there's not a lot of lessons necessarily, there is a lot of things in the Bible that are of an interest to a carpenter. You have things like Noah's Ark, and that was a major construction thing for its time. It took a lot of tools that, you know, the evolutionist would probably say we didn't have access to. The tabernacle and its furnishings, the temple, the blueprints for the rebuilt Jerusalem, Ezekiel 40 through chapter 45. It's just amazing. God spends so many chapters of Scripture describing buildings. There's a lot of verses in giving directions and blueprints, so to speak, of how things are supposed to be made according to a pattern, and great detail about all these things. New Jerusalem in Revelation. As a carpenter, you're working with wood, you begin looking at trees differently. You walk through the woods, you're not looking at it as firewood, you're not necessarily looking at it as a good tree for deer stand. What would that wood be good for? It's nice and straight, it'll have straight grain. It has a branch coming off, it's got crotch wood, it's going to have a lot of nice grain in there. There's some knots on that tree that would provide a lot of character to something. And it's interesting as you go through the Bible how many different woods are mentioned. And I don't know that this is an exhaustive list, but yeah, gopher wood, acacia wood, cedar, fir, fig, sycamore, olive, cypress, vine, citron, oak, ebony, palm, pomegranate, apple, and then one place it says very costly wood, which is what you get at the craftsman's store. A lot of exotic woods, and you can do some very beautiful things with it. One of the finer things the carpenters could do was make paneling. And in the making paneling, they would carve into it figures and things. A lot of carving would be done by the carpenter. So carpentry could make some very beautiful things.